from Midori House in London, and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's programme, passion, partnerships and painting. We discuss how couples impact one another's art. Also coming up, we examine creativity on the inside as inmates use art to help deal with prison life. Also ahead, how do you buy less junk?
A huge amount of society and the way the world is set up at the moment is all geared to get us buying a constant churn of throwaway items.
We look at how to keep your mind and your household rather clear. And we discuss the London pizza scene with the owner of one of the city's newest pizzerias.
I would like to start talking about a London pizza because I don't think London has a defined pizza as much as New York or Chicago. So it will be great one day to talk about London pizza.
Plus, we go through the weekend papers with the journalist Marie Billon. That's all to come this hour live from London with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. It is a century since the birth of Paul Feiler, the internationally acclaimed painter who formed a part of a group of artists who lived and worked near to the town of St Ives in the southwest of England. Feiler shared his life and his profession with his wife, Catherine Armitage, and an exhibition of the couple's work is currently being held at the Redfern Gallery, one of the longest established dealers of modern British art in London. Also coming up this autumn is a huge exhibition at the Barbican, also here in London. Modern Couples explores what happens when modern art and modern love come together. Well, these exhibitions got us thinking about artistic couples, what happens when they do work, what happens when they don't. And I'm delighted to say that Catherine Armitage joins me in this studio now. Welcome, Catherine. And I'm also joined by Jane Allison, who's Head of Visual Arts at the Barbican Centre in London, and Coralie Malizard, who's Assistant Curator at the Barbican. Welcome, ladies, to Monocle 24. Catherine, could you briefly tell us about your life and work with your late husband? You met him and what happened?
I met him when I was 21 and he was 26 years older than me, but it was instant attraction and understanding, and just from then on we lived together forever. And he was already an established artist, and I did know this, but he didn't talk about it very much when we first met. I was working for an interior designer. So I was always interested in colour and shapes and fabric and things like that, but I'd never done any art. And when I'd known him for about a year, I said to him, "Will you teach me to draw?" And he said, "I can't teach you. Draw." So he gave me a huge piece of paper and a very thick lead pencil. And I said, "Well, what shall I draw?" And he said, "Draw me." So he lay back on a cushion, fully dressed, and I drew a tiny little picture of him right in the middle. And he looked at it and he said, "My God, you'll never do anything as good as that again." And that was in March. And by the end of the year, I had been accepted at the Slade as a student. So he had, as you can see, an amazing influence on me. But he was never my teacher. I went to evening classes in Bristol. And he was always my mentor, but never my teacher, really. But the most important thing he did was teach me to look at things. You know, I remember driving about with him in the countryside and we stopped at one particular place and there was looking over the Mendips and he just said, "Look and look," and he's showing me things that I could see suddenly, and it was just wonderful. And from then on he was my mentor, and I was at the Slade for 4 years, and then I did 2 years extra as a postgraduate doing etching. And when I left I was pregnant with twins. So my work was put on hold in a way. I mean, I did think that I hadn't done any work until the children were 18, but then when I looked back, I had actually done quite a few paintings during the years. But it never felt like that, really.
The delightful thing that you mentioned there is this balance between two artists going out on a journey and looking, which two creatives would do. And then you have, and then we had a baby. And there's this, you had two babies at the same time. Yeah. Well done. There was that, how much was your creative life and your everyday putting out the bins, feeding the kids life intertwined? Or did you allocate spaces and times for each other separately?
Paul was a full-time painter, absolutely. He was born with a paintbrush in his hand. And so painting for him was like work. He went in the morning and worked, and then he came home for lunch, and then he went in the afternoon and came back for supper. And that was every day, all day. But he was extremely practical, and he did all the jobs in the house, and he put out the bins. Although I can... No, that's not a story you didn't know about back then. And I mean, he was a very, very loving father, but we did have twins, and it was the time before nappies, you know, that you can just plop on. And so I used to change nappies. I had 20 nappies every day, and he changed one nappy, I think, all the time. So that's my part, and he was the painter. But I'm making it sound rather bad, aren't I?
Not necessarily. I'm hoping that there's going to be a but coming up.
But he was incredibly encouraging as far as I was concerned, and always wanted me to be painting and working and things like that. And I was basically rather lazy and used to say, make up excuses that I had to wash the nappies, for instance. But he was always encouraging, and the later and later, you know, more and more encouraging when I was able to spend more time doing it.
Jane, this new exhibition at the Barbican called Modern Couples has been billed in some way, and some of the literature behind it says this is examining the end of solo genius. And I think we've sort of seen what happened with Catherine and her husband there. We have a man who's already established, an extremely skilled and talented artist, and then a woman comes into his world, and she may not necessarily be the, you know, an artist pre-existing, yet that combination suddenly creates a credible and brilliant artist in their own right.
Yeah, I mean, sure, this is a story about, well, essentially about modern art and modern love. And it's the first time there's been an exhibition on this scale looking at the importance of relationship, looking at the importance of desire and love. And mutual influence, co-authorship, collaboration. It was lovely the way you talked about your husband being essentially your inspiration. And I think for too long, I mean, women have been sidelined in this story, the women in a couple. And we've tended to think of our history as this lineage of male solo genius. And we are in this show correcting that. So it's a wonderful opportunity to forefront the importance of women artists, but essentially to look at this idea that art comes out of a creative dialogue. And just as the relationships are creative, that gave rise to, you know, some extraordinary artworks.
Are we seeing in the exhibition who we might not necessarily think, oh, gosh, they were associated with them?
Ah, well, there's quite a lot of them. Well, one couple that springs to mind that we're super excited to include is Federico Garcia Lorca and Salvador Dali. So there's much speculation actually about the extent of their sexual intimacy, shall we say? But undoubtedly, they were utterly intoxicated with each other at a period in their lives where they were becoming artists. I mean, they were becoming the artists we know. And, you know, Dali became more of a writer, and Lorca became an extraordinary draftsman. And you can really see the synchronicity in their work.
Is there a lot of... Coralie, is there a lot of synchronicity that you find when you were putting these exhibitions together between artists who have in the past been exhibited separately? And then when you put their work side by side, you suddenly see the relationship, both professional and personal, reflected in what you're exhibiting.
I think, yeah, that is definitely the case in this exhibition. And what really comes out is the different types of influences artists had with each other, but also the different kinds of artistic relationships they chose to have. So some of them, for example, Emily Pfluger would never really be exhibited in an art exhibition as a creative. She's often been sidelined as a muse, or she would be included maybe in a fashion story about how her couture house was this radical incubator for Viennese design, for liberating the body, for liberating form and colour. And in this exhibition, when you see Klimt's work alongside what Emily Pflugger was doing with her fashion house, you really see the influence. You really see how their shared collections of textile, their interest in folk art, comes into their art. For example, she was really sewing pieces of Slovakian textiles onto her really amazing reform dresses, which liberated the female body from the corset. And then when you see Klimt's paintings, which are very lavishly decorated, you can see that they were, you know, having this dialogue. But then what really came out from this research for this exhibition is often artists, when they were working together, had several professional relationships. They were at the same time each other's muse. Sometimes they were the student. Sometimes they were artists in their own right. And there's this oscillation between, as you were saying, Picasso becomes Dora Maar's muse, but then also Dora Maar has been, you know, remembered as Picasso's muse. But there was much more of a complex and multi-layered dialogue between both partners.
This is something that's difficult. I think Picasso once said to one of his partners, I can't remember which one, you will always be defined as being my ex-lover. And that's, you know, that's an absolute curse in so many ways. Catherine, just going back to having your husband already as an established artist, how often were you Mrs. Paul Filer? And at what point did you stop being Mrs. Paul Filer and start being Catherine Armitage, the artist?
Quite late on, yes. I never considered myself as anything other than Mrs. Paul Filer. That was me rather than him. I didn't have the confidence. It sounds funny because people think I have been confident, but I haven't, and I didn't have the confidence, in spite of him saying, yes, you are good. I always thought it was because he loved me that he said that. It wasn't necessarily because he, you know what I mean, thought it, but he did think it. And so I can't remember when I had my first exhibition as Catherine Armitage. I mean, I've always painted under Armitage. I didn't want to have his name. But it did happen quite late, yes.
Do you ever, Jane, get examples coming towards you of an excellent artist with perhaps a slightly less thrilling couple? And, you know, you get couples, the weaker partner riding on the coattails as being Mr. or Mrs. such and such, who sort of push to get into galleries and get themselves exhibited. And there's an element of Emperor's New Clothes about them.
Well, I don't think they're in our show. We had so many couples to choose from, obviously, and we started with a very long list. So it was important, obviously, that the both artists in the couple were strong artists in their own right. And of course, you know, it's interesting because, as I was saying, often it's the woman who has been in the couple who has been forgotten. But in some cases, with Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, her reputation, of course, has eclipsed his. And so it's very interesting to have a work by him in the show. And of course, we have very different kinds of relationships in the exhibition. And that was super important for us that we're... There's a whole spectrum of different types of relationship, homosexual, heterosexual, bisexual, and people that were very fluid in their relationship. So, Coraline, you...
I also, because the show is multidisciplinary, it also enables us to look at people who were creatives but who weren't necessarily artists in the sense of fine artists. So we have a lot of women who were really important cultural incubators who directed printing presses that enabled writers to be published for the first time, away from censorship, away from all these kind of academic traditions that wouldn't have enabled new, you know, transgressive poets to be published. And so they're not necessarily artists in the sense of Picasso being a painter or whatever, but what they did really changed the cultural landscape of the early 20th century. And
a lot of this is assuming that everybody's relationship was great, that everything was collaborative and wonderful and everybody was blissfully happy. This wasn't necessarily the case. Did you ever find conflicting or tense relationships producing rather thrilling art?
Going back to Picasso and Dora Maar, I mean, that wasn't an easy relationship, for instance. But possibly that tension fueled some of the work. We begin the exhibition with Rodin and Camille Claudel, and that relationship ended somewhat tragically, as she, you know, she wanted to be an independent artist. She wanted to have her own visual language, and she had to struggle to achieve that.
There's also a lot of work in this show that it's quite transgressive on an erotic level, and it's difficult for us today, without being in the intimacy of a relationship, to understand these works. But what we've tried to do in this exhibition is to also weave in the artists' voices, some of their correspondence and diaries and photographs, to try and not see work in isolation, but belonging to a body of work and a dialogue that, for example, the work might be quite objectifying in a way, but maybe in a lot of cases there was this dialogue, and Una Kazern or Lee Miller, who were also creatives in their own right, were using the camera or the canvas as a way of having this libidinal dialogue with their lover.
Catherine, how did being professionally, creatively connected influence your relationship? The reason why I asked that is I was examining it. I occasionally work with my husband, and we always find it a refreshing, welcome tonic to the daily grind of the bins and the childcare and this, that and the other, to be able to place yourself outside the home and actually see the other for being an incredibly talented, professional, and we find it very exciting. Did you find the same thing?
Absolutely, and that's why I'm excited about this exhibition, because I work in quite a small studio now, and my studio was crammed with all the paintings, and then 3 weeks ago my studio suddenly became empty, and so I'm looking forward to seeing the same paintings which I've been looking at for the last 4 years in a new context and hung by somebody different. I'm leaving the gallery to do the hanging, so that I'm going to walk in just like any other punter and see my work. And I'm looking forward to that enormously. And also pause as well upstairs, because although I know it very well, like I know my own work, always seeing it in a new situation is very, very exciting.
And when you worked together, how much influence and input would you give to each other's work?
I've thought about that, and we did discuss it very much, and he always showed me what he was doing, and we talked about it, and the same with me too. I mean, he looked at my work and was very encouraging, and I think I was encouraging to him, because we both thought each other was very good. But we did discuss it, but we didn't... apart from that, it was more just the sort of... the generosity of knowing that there was someone there who really believed in you was lovely.
Catherine Armitage, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio. And thanks too to Jane Allison and Coralie Malissal. Modern Couples, Art, Intimacy and the Avant-Garde runs at the Barbican Art Gallery from the 10th of October to January next year. And Paul Filer, Elusive Space, a Centenary Retrospective at the Redfern Gallery, not to mention your exhibition too, Catherine, is from the 26th of September to the end of next month at the Redfern Gallery in London. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Up next, we look at how artwork is helping prisoners deal with life inside. Stay with us.
Stay one step ahead of the breaking news.
People are saying, look, enough is enough. The middle class is getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. The rich are getting richer. And they're saying, look, this is not a fair game.
Hear industry-leading insights from our experts.
When tech companies have problems, they can go south very quickly. BlackBerry, Nokia, nowhere near the companies they used to be, but both were invincible. Nokia boasted that they were one of the first companies on the planet to sell 1 billion of their products.
And catch up with Monocle's Bureau around the world. Every weekday at noon London time, keep your appointment with The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Curtains up. Premiering in Monocle's October issue is our very first culture preview. From big box film releases to the art market's latest moves, we guide you through all you need to watch, see and read this autumn. On our global tour, we take a peek into Helsinki's newest museum to find out how Finland's art scene is stepping up its game and consider the future of Nordic noir. Is the Scandi bubble about to burst? Not to mention more finds from Switzerland to Taiwan. In our fashion pages, our biannual Top 50 will deliver all the scarves, coats and knits you need to keep cosy and suitably sharp. Autumnal breeze or not, Tom Ford isn't afraid to bear it all. We hear from the American designer on why it's the perfect time to launch a line of underwear. We sit down with Iceland's Prime Minister to find out how the left-wing environmentalist thawed her countrymen's suspicion of politicians and get a few tips from developers and retailers making the high street worth celebrating. Plus, we meet the architects rethinking our homes for a more sustainable future. The Monocle October issue is out now on all good newsstands. Do get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Sunday Brunch. It's Emma Nelson here. The time here in London is 10:22. We stay with art. I'm Still Here is an exhibition at London's South Bank, which features the art of Britain's prisoners. From secure patients and detainees, as well as people on community sentences, the work has been selected by five different families of those inside. So how does life behind bars affect your artwork? And does indeed making art help you while you're in prison? Well, to tell us more, Sally Taylor is the CEO of the Koestler Trust, the charity behind the exhibition. And I'm delighted to say she joins me in the studio. Welcome to Monocle 24, Sally. I'm
delighted to be here.
Tell us about your exhibition, what it looks like and who's exhibiting.
Well, we're absolutely delighted to continue our partnership with the South Bank Centre. It's in the Royal Festival Hall in their exhibition space there, lasting for about 6 weeks. It opened this week. And it represents a real breadth of work that comes from secure settings in this country, from, as you rightly say, young offenders, secure mental health patients, immigration removal centres, as well, of course, as from a wide range of our prisons. And this is based on our annual awards, which we've been running since 1962. We have about 7,500 artistic entries across a very wide range of art forms for the awards, and from the awards comes the curation of the exhibition. And in the show, you'll find about 220 pieces across an extraordinarily wide range of art forms, not just the visual arts, but also music and poetry as well.
What's it like trying to select artwork from a group of people who aren't naturally artists? And I would imagine that there's an awful lot of goodwill there, wishing to exhibit the work of somebody who's clearly in an incredibly tough situation, and this offers them escape. Yet at the same time, it must pass a certain test of quality. How good is this artwork?
I would say that actually it really speaks to people. It has, some of the artwork is technically absolutely extraordinary, but all of it comes from someone who wants to say something. And I think for me, it's an extraordinarily honest exhibition. You know, you've got people who want to talk about, through their art, their experiences of being inside, or how they feel about their relations outside, or the people they've left behind, or what their hopes are for the future.
I mean, are there running themes going through there? Because obviously when you are deprived of your freedom, you're deprived of your experience that, you know, that you and I would see every single day. So how is what they are experiencing inside an institution influencing what they're producing?
Well, sometimes it's actually pretty basic. So you've got, in terms of, we have extraordinary watercolours of cells, for example, or we have 3D work of a prison cell. But we also have people who have a memory of maybe actually doing, in one particular instance, a family came around the exhibition yesterday and told me the story of a piece that his mother had done about a canal boat holiday that they had had when she was out, and, you know, he was able to have a relationship with her, and so she had drawn a picture of what that meant to her, and it was a extraordinarily moving moment to have her young son, who can only see her once a month on a prison visit, talking about what that how that piece of art had sort of brought them together and what it means to him.
You've chosen not to describe the offences or the reasons why people are inside when you're exhibiting their work. Why did you do that?
It's a very, very deliberate decision. We want people to see the art and not the artist. And so when you do come to the show, you'll see that with most of the artwork, we're able to give Christian names. So it will, for example, say Fred HMP Wormwood Scrubs. But you have no idea who Fred is. You have no idea what Fred's done, and neither do we. Very clear that Fred is an artist and has got something to say. He happens to be in prison. Indeed, quite a lot of our artists have started their art life, if you like, while they are in prison. Very many of them discover a talent that they never knew they had. It's great for their self-confidence, great for their self-esteem, and in some cases, actually, some of the art is done as a group, as a team. So one of the extraordinary pieces in the show is called The Seven-Headed Hydra of Mental Health, and it comes from some young people in a mental health secure setting, and it's an extraordinary piece made of papier-mâché.
How do you make sure, how does art get into prisons nowadays or into institutions? You work for a trust which promotes this kind of stuff, but what is the process, and how common is it now for, if you are sentenced to however long behind bars, there is an opportunity for you to explore your artistic side? It's not something that people conventionally imagine goes on.
No, that's true. And increasingly, in terms of the cuts that are happening in the prison service, it's sadly something that does fall off the end. There are some absolutely remarkable men and women working in prisons as art tutors or doing projects that go into prisons or artists in residence. There's a prison called Grendon that has a remarkable photographer, Edmund Clark, who's been an artist in residence for about 3 years there and had an exhibition at the Icon in Birmingham last year as a sort of culmination of that. But yes, you're right, it's patchy. Not everybody's able to have access to an art room, but of course there are things that people can do which mean that they can do it in their cell. So, for example, poetry is something you can write. Our greatest category, actually, is individual poem. Drawings you can do. And then there's old-fashioned prison artwork like matchsticks and soap, which is absolutely extraordinary work. In fact, if you went to the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition this year, there was a piece there which was 99 soap sculptures done by someone who has been associated with the Kersler Trust, and there it was on the walls of the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition. We were astonishingly proud of that.
How did that make you feel, Brave?
Oh, we were thrilled. We were thrilled. We had a group outing, especially.
What does art do for you if you are inside?
I think there are all sorts of ways that art can support you while you're inside. First of all, it may be an outlet for emotions that actually you might find difficult to deal with in another way. Clearly, in some places, there is art therapy as well. We tend not to take that work. We tend to take the creative work rather than, I'm not saying art therapy isn't creative, of course I'm not, but people tend to want to maybe keep that to themselves. It can be used as a means of communication. Very frequently, people do not want to sell their work, for example, although we do sell the work, because they want it for their mother or their daughter or their granddaughter or something like that. And also, it helps them concentrate on something other than being in prison. It could be an outlet in that regard too.
Culturally, however, prisons are very tough places.
Yeah.
How easy is it for someone who is living in an incredibly harsh place, actually turn around and almost bravely say, I want to be creative? Is it a tough jump to make?
I think it very much depends on where you are. Although we have got some extraordinary work in the show, actually, from Wakefield Prison, which is one of the most secure prisons in the country. But frequently people find that actually when they have got a talent inside, some other men on the wing may want them to help them make their greetings cards for birthdays or that sort of thing, or help them write poetry home. So it's, I think that we hope we can support people across a very broad range of all our prisons here, and I hope that people will come to the show and they can see the talent that comes from inside, and also may change the way that they think about prisoners as well. You know, they are human beings. They have emotions, they have thoughts, they have feelings, just the same as all the rest of us. And a very great many of those are on the walls at the South Bank for the next 6 weeks.
Thank you very much indeed, Sally. Sally Taylor there. I'm Still Here runs at London South Bank until the 4th of November. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Art to books on Sunday Brunch. Tara Button is the CEO of Buy Me Once, a website dedicated to selling items you'll only need to buy once in your life. She's just released her first book, A Life Less Throwaway, which aims to teach a new lifestyle to the consumer generation. And as part of our weekend read, she spoke to Georgina Godwin about her book.
When I was growing up, my mother used to say, it doesn't matter how much pocket money you give Tara, she's always spent it before you've given it to her, in contrast to my sister, who was always very careful with her money. So actually, you know, all the way through to, I would say, my kind of late 20s, I had quite a spendthrift attitude to money. It was always like, well, as soon as I've got some money, what can I spend it on? Mm. And kind of just looking for the first thing that caught my eye rather than thinking mindfully about what I might need. And that all changed actually when I got into quite a lot of credit card debt, which was awful, really, really just a horrible experience. And then I was given a Le Creuset pot for my 30th birthday. It was kind of the first time when I thought, you know, I'm going to have this wonderful item for a lifetime. And I, gosh, I wish the other things that I'd bought or you know, had been given in my life was something that would carry me through for my entire life, not just, you know, for now. And that got me thinking that this was the right way to go about buying, and it kind of created a completely new mindset when it came to purchasing.
Mm. And how difficult was it then to really alter your mindset?
Well, it is quite difficult because my natural impulse is towards impulse buying. So it is something that I have to kind of actively fight against. So I have huge empathy for anyone who, you know, is a shopaholic or finds it difficult not to see something and get it immediately. But what I found is that actually the benefits of buying for life have overcome that impulse, because I now find a huge amount of joy in finding the right things and taking care of those things and knowing that does its bit for my bank balance, for the environment. And what you end up with is a home and a wardrobe which is much calmer, much more nurturing than what happens if you kind of buy for now and you just end up with a house full of mismatched clutter. You know that awful feeling when you get your wardrobe and you're like, I've got all these clothes and I don't want to wear any of them. And that kind of comes from the buying mindset, where you kind of go to a shop when you have maybe a particular event or something that you're buying for, and you have to buy something now, and so you don't really have time to research, and you just kind of grab something that will do, and then you have a whole wardrobe full of stuff that will do, but you don't really love it.
Mm, absolutely.
That's part of the problem.
Yeah, yeah, I keep having to remind myself that everything I wear is new to the people I'm wearing it in front of, usually, even if it's
absolutely
not new to me. Yeah. So tell us about your book, A Life Less Throwaway. What do you outline in there?
The book has kind of two parts to it, I would say. The first part is all about the broken behaviour and the reasons why we buy impulsively. And essentially, it's because a huge amount of society and the way the world is set up at the moment is all geared to get us buying a constant churn of throwaway items. So part of that is that products aren't made to last, perhaps in the way that they used to be. So planned obsolescence is a huge thing. Clothing that is not made to last at all, and that takes its toll. But then you've also got the other side, which is the kind of rather than the physical, it's more of the psychological side, which is, you know, the advertising and the marketing that goes behind things. And I worked in advertising for 10 years, so I know all the tricks of the trade. And that's very much about speaking to our subconscious and telling us that our lives will be better if only we buy this, if only we buy that. And, you know, unfortunately, those messages kind of sink in. They make us feel insecure. They make us feel like we have to be purchasing to be happy. And that's just not the case. Mm. The second half of the book is how we can fight against that behaviour and find our own way. So we're digging into our own priorities, our own sense of style, and finding what's actually important to us so that we can, I call it mindful curation, which is when you mindfully curate the items in your life to create a physical world around you which makes sense for you. And that will be individual to the person.
And that would ease any kind of psychological ills to a degree, wouldn't it? I mean, uncluttered life, uncluttered mind, that sort of thing.
Definitely. I mean, you know that wonderful feeling when you walk into a lovely hotel room and it's all clean and it's all kind of wonderfully uncluttered, you know, until you start unpacking and throwing everything around. It's having that when you come into your own home, I have to say, is a wonderful, freeing experience, having that sense of space. It almost gives you a sense of possibility. It means that you're not constantly feeling like you're having to keep up with life, like you're constantly on the back foot. It means that you become on the front foot and it's like, oh, well, what am I going to do today? Because I have this wonderful clean slate and it's great, I have to say, yes.
Now, you also run a decluttering service and I wonder how difficult it is to convince people that they need to get rid of their stuff.
Well, when you come into anyone's home, you have to be really careful about the way you approach things, because what's important to me isn't necessarily going to be important to them, and vice versa. So you can't kind of go up to people and be, oh, you know, this old table, you can't possibly like that, you know, of course you want to get rid of that. What I find is that it's best to kind of start with things that are unemotional. So things like your underwear drawer or your spice rack. Yeah, it's about getting people to see what they have, because very often, you know, our houses over time, they've become so cluttered that we can't really see what we have. So, you know, classic example is, you know, I went into a friend's kitchen and I was helping her clear out, and she had some candle holders, and I was like, well, great, do you light these candle holders and do you use them and when would you use them? She's like, oh yes, I want to use them. And I was like, well, are there any other candle holders in your house? And, you know, as she went around the room, she kind of ended up with more and more candle holders, and she had loads, you know, that she'd been given over time. She had about 25 of them. So then she was able to go, well, actually, I'm probably not going to use all of these candle holders. So, you know, I'll keep these two sets that I like, you know, one's maybe a bit more funky and one's a bit more traditional, and I'll keep these and the rest can go. So so much of it is just actually just seeing what you have and then really thinking about the times that you use things and being really honest with yourself about the life you actually have rather than the life you feel you should have. And then if there's something like, you know, maybe a musical instrument that you want to play, you know, because a lot of items in our homes are like this, that there's something that you want to use rather than something that you actually use, I would put a best before date on that. You know, sometimes physically, like get a Sharpie out and write a little label on that item and go, well, you know what, if I haven't made any effort towards learning to play the guitar before June, then actually maybe I'm kidding myself and I just need to let this guitar go. Or give yourself the time to do it. But if it is just sitting there making you feel guilty, it's a drain on your energy and your psyche rather than, you know, adding something to it.
Finally, Tara, what are the absolute staples that you personally have in your home or handbag?
Staples in my handbag. A lot of the things in my handbag are there to stop me from buying disposable stuff. And, you know, there's been a lot in the press recently about disposable plastic, which is obviously a massive issue. And luckily, because of Blue Planet, people are paying attention now. So, you know, I have a wonderful clean canteen bottle, which can fit either coffee or water in it. And that stops me from buying disposable coffee cups and bottles of water. I have a titanium spork, which means I don't have to pick up cutlery. I've got handkerchiefs so that I don't have disposable tissues. And yeah, I have a wonderful purse, which was actually an heirloom from my grandmother. It was her cigarette case from the 1940s. So it's very beautiful. So I've got kind of a mixture of very practical things, including my pen that writes for a lifetime. It's got enough ink to write for a lifetime. So my handbag's full of kind of things that I completely rely on, and, you know, the odd meaningful thing like my purse from my grandmother. And I think that that's the kind of the best way to create your life, is a kind of mixture of things that really serve you well, that you can completely rely on and feel safe using, and things that bring you kind of great joy and emotional resonance.
That was Tara Button talking to Georgina Godwin there. A Life Less Throwaway is out now. And to hear more from Georgina, check out Meet the Writers. You can find the full back catalogue online at monocle.com. Up next on Sunday Brunch, we go through the weekend papers. Marie Bion is standing by.
Are you fed up with the white noise that often passes for news coverage? Do you want something more than soundbite journalism when it comes to the big issues of the day? Then join Monocle's editors and guests for The View from Midori House. Informed analysis, serious debate, and lively discussion. Every weekday at 1800 London time, tune in to Midori House on Monocle 24.
10:41 here in London, so we're mid-morning in London on a Sunday, so there's nothing else to do but read the papers. And I hope wherever you are, you've had a stroll to your local kiosk and picked up something good to read yourself. To go through the papers and give us a bit of a taste as to what is going on, I'm delighted to say Marie Bion, the journalist for French media, joins me in the studio. Hello, Marie.
Hello.
Hello. Right, so let us crack straight on. We don't normally talk, we try to avoid talking about Brexit, but we kind of have to this week in context of the Labour Political Party conference in, where is it, Liverpool?
In Liverpool, right? Liverpool, yes. Yeah. So it's not so much about Brexit, it's more about basically the soul of the Labour Party. Because, of course, during this, there is this conference, there's going to be many questions that will be at the forefront, but Brexit, of course, will be. And the idea is that basically there's a poll in The Observer saying that 86% of the Labour members now, according to a survey surveying 1,000 people, member of the Labour, 86% of them want to have a second referendum. The problem is, of course, is that Jeremy Corbyn is not in favour of a people's vote. He is in favour of another general election because he thinks that basically he can boot out the Tory and go to Downing Street instead. So at the moment, 86% of the members want a people's vote, but the leadership doesn't want a people's vote. The problem is, of course, as well, is that since Jeremy Corbyn took over the Labour Party, he said he wanted to give back the party to the members. He wanted to be a members' party and not just a party basically directed by the elite of the party. So when 86% of the members want something but the leadership doesn't want something, doesn't want the same thing, that doesn't spell the fact that the Labour Party is a member. As a member party. So during this conference, there's going to be this very big fight about the soul of the Labour Party. Does Jeremy Corbyn is just another one of those leaders who just want to do what he wants to do? Or is he really true to his word? Is he really going to listen to what the membership want?
Yes, it's unusual because I think there's an excellent four-page special on the soul of the Labour Party, as you describe it, in this week's Observer, which I suppose is the one paper that would give it that amount of space. But there's this great commentary on page 6 that says, as the party gathers in Liverpool, is Corbyn's promise to empower his members coming back to haunt him? It has been a leadership that has been dogged by accusations of autocracy and a silence from the leadership when it comes to things that matters enormously to Labour voters and to Labour members. There has been tremendous criticism of him, of Jeremy Corbyn, for never really coming out to talk about Brexit. He never gives a response. And the British government at the moment, it's doing its very best at doing an incredibly bad job of the Brexit negotiations. One would imagine that this is an open goal for any opposition party to bring them down. And yet he doesn't seem to do this. And the articles in this newspaper today suggest that this is a big flaw he's got.
This is a big flaw he's got. That's what the paper may be saying. But the strategy is very, very clear. As long as Jeremy Corbyn doesn't basically come out from one side or the other, basically when he's still basically hovering in terms of his positioning on the EU, he can basically, when the government is really, really in a pickle, more than it is today, he can just, spring out of the woods saying, oh, well, this is my decision. So because I see that the wind is blowing towards a second people's vote, let's go with that. But if the wind is blowing to another direction, because he hasn't taken a strict position, he can go with this other solution. So it's a very strategical positioning. And I think it means quite a lot in terms of this battle for the soul of the Labour Party. He's already proven so far that his lack of commitment means that he's very much into politicking, into basically trying to find what's the best for him and the party and his policies, more than basically what some of the members and some of the public wants to see, which is an opposition party opposing very clearly the policy of the government.
Okay, we shall see. This is the beginning of conference season, isn't it? We've had the Liberal Democrats. Mm-hmm. They came and went. Labour this week, and then the great
bun fight of the Conservatives the following week. That's going to be interesting to look at. Right, let us turn to the Sunday Telegraph, page 17. Going to the United States, could Texas turn Democrat? That's an interesting idea.
Yes, that's the story, basically. And they're saying that, Cruz, of course, who was the second, who just basically lost to Trump a few years ago now, and wasn't the nominee for the Republicans, he may well, during this midterm election, lose his seat. That's what the paper is saying. His lead is now in one-figure digit. And the Democrats are more and more popular. Cruz has a very, very tough stance on immigration. In Texas, that did work very well because, of course, we are quite close to the border, and some people have very, very have very strong views on immigration. But we've all that Trump did with the immigrants, with the separating of the children and their parents, the views have shifted in many places in the U.S. And in this state in particular, when something like 30% of the population is Spanish, of a Spanish descent, Spanish descent basically, or Mexican descent more precisely, and they are more and more open to another discourse on immigration. And the candidate, Mr. O'Rourke, for the Democrats, has this more, you know, soft view on immigration, which is if you are illegal, you have to be sent back. But there should be many, many people, many possibilities for the Dreamers to come and settle legally into the US. So this idea is having traction at the moment, apparently.
And let's talk a little bit more about this man, O'Rourke. This Beto O'Rourke is his name, Beto O'Rourke, a 45-year-old, and it sort of sums up a little bit about, OK, you have totally different ideologies, but the fact is that he's incredibly good at connecting with liberal America, and he's ticked all the right boxes as well. It says he talks about inclusion, optimism. I mean, talking about that in Texas is pretty brave talking. But he's also done stuff like he's gone onto the Stephen Colbert Show, Ellen DeGeneres. Mm-hmm. And this is a guy who clearly knows how to play the media in order to try and reclaim the centre ground. It's a very clever thing to do because America's liberal media, well, America's media, many of it is pretty liberal, and there are characters, there's a real need for characters like this guy, isn't there?
Yes, especially at the moment when Trump is doing the other thing, basically. A likable character is something that I think the American want to see handling or being basically in the room when the power is yielded. And he seems to be a very, you know, not a populist guy, but a people's guy in a way, and that's something that you have to be when you want to win a state. Perhaps Cruz, having been almost the nominee for the Republicans, has more of a distance touch with the population. But this guy, being young, going to all these shows that the young people watch, and being out on the street shaking hands, that's something that's making apparently quite an impact. That's what the Sunday Telegraph says anyway.
Okay, let's move on to the Financial Times. Pub landlords are struggling to call time on Tide beers. Now, Tide beers, it's quite difficult to explain. Pubs in the United Kingdom aren't that. They're supposed to be independent, but they are what's known as tied to certain breweries, which mean, forgive me if I get this wrong, Mary, you have to buy the beer off the brewery that you have to buy the beer off a certain brewery. You can't get different beers from different breweries. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it has led to an awful lot of breweries and pubs falling out and pubs really getting into trouble as a result of this.
Yes, absolutely. So that's what we call the beer tie. And basically what the big names are saying is that you have to buy our beer for a price that's perhaps a bit above the market, but we give you a rent that's significantly lower than what you would find on the market. And that's something that was kind of the rule until 2016. And in 2016, the government decided to cut or to allow for the cutting of the beer tie and allowing pub owners basically to just have rent only, in a way, a lease only contract with the big names. The problem is, and that's what the story is about, is that many landlords, with the emerging of the, you know, the craft beers and the wish to have all the beers than only the brand beers, they wanted to sever this beer tie and go alone, basically. But the big names were not happy with that. And I said, yes, okay, legally, you can go and just have a lease. But you're going to have to pay 3 months in advance. You're going to have to pay this. You're going to have to pay that. And basically, one of the landlords said that he had to put on the table more than £10,000 if he wanted to, at the end of his lease, if he wanted to basically change the way he worked with a big brand. And he couldn't basically afford this. And out of the 12,000 pubs that could have been benefit from the surveying of the beer tie, only 53 so far in 2 years have been able to do that, meaning that big names are really, really in favour of not allowing them to go it alone, because they make the most profit on the beer selling and less on the rent.
The difficulties of having a British tradition. Speaking of British traditions, let's head finally to the Sunday Times. The Town Crier.
Yes, they're back.
Frankly, they've never gone away for me. I love
no,
them.
Well,
they get, for anybody who doesn't know what one is, when there's a royal birth, generally someone rocks up in front of a hospital with a bell and a silly hat and goes, oh yay, hear ye, but possibly with a little bit more oomph. And anyway, yes. Apparently they've gone away, but no, Marie Billon, they are back.
They are back. 150 towns and cities have their own crier now. And it's not just to announce, you know, new laws or because there's a council meeting or something like that. The stores, the shops are using them to attract people into their shops. With the declining of the high streets, shops or councils have decided to hire the stone criers to basically shout the good news of this shop is doing that, this shop is doing this, and this kind of thing. So it attracts people into the shop. It's a kind of a nice feel and ambience in the street, and it's good for the shop owners.
Do you think it'll beat Twitter?
Well, it would be a nice short video. Oh yeah, go to Sainsbury's or go to Tesco because they have good marmalades today. That's
brilliant.
That's fun, isn't
that's
it?
That's great, the great marmalade thing. Right. Thank you very much indeed, Marie. I wonder whether they're bringing these things back in a kind of post-Brexit, let's rebuild medieval Britain to try to make us feel a little bit better about ourselves.
Yes, better.
Marie Billon, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Sunday Brunch. You're listening to Monocle 24. It's 10:53 here in London, and I know this programme is called Sunday Brunch, but if you're listening in, let's say, Athens or indeed Moscow, it is almost lunchtime, so let's head to a lunchtime item. And we head to Clapham here in London, where the former director of the luxury fruit and vegetable supplier Natura has turned his hand to the world of pizza. Manifesto boasts an evolving seasonal menu and authentic Italian suppliers. Well, we sent Monocle's David Stevens to have a chat with Vittorio Maschio about his new business venture.
Well, I started in the food industry, coming from the finance industry about 15 years ago. My first company making pasta, which then merged with Natura about 8 years ago. And after 8 years at Natura, I thought it was time for me to move on and doing something slightly different. Always been in the back of my brain for a while. And I just decided to go ahead with it.
Can you explain the name Manifesto? I know there's a lot of meaning behind the name itself.
Manifesto is a little bit of a statement in the sense that we aim to offer the best quality organic food to everyone. So the lowest price. Everyone has the right to get access to a cheap, well-done meal.
And it has an interesting seasonal tagline as well. Can you explain the idea behind the seasonal menu?
Well, I got so used to work with seasonal vegetables that I could not stop applying the same principle. So I know it's not very common in the pizza world, but why not? If we have vegetables, as we do have on the menu, let's try to use seasonal vegetables.
It's an apollo pizza, ricotta, chili.
Traditional pizza, obviously Italian pizza, is meant to kind of reflect the area it's in. Do you think Manifesto pizza is a London pizza, or even a Southwest London pizza, or where does it kind of originate from?
Well, I would like to start talking about the London pizza because I don't think London has a defined pizza as much as New York or Chicago. So it will be great one day to talk about London pizza. It seems to be pretentious of me now talking about London pizza, having just established my first site only 1 week ago. So I'm not going to do that now, but it would be lovely one day to talk about London pizza, yeah.
And the style of pizza you make here, is it borrowing from Italian influence? Is it a certain area in Italy that you got this sort of idea from?
This pizza is not traditional of any part of Italy. The bigger style that we use is traditionally, historically used for bread in the south of Italy, to use the lowest amount of yeast, all natural, 48 hours process, but it's traditionally used for bread and not for pizza.
You talked about the seasonal nature and the seasonal produce, and we are going from a very hot summer into what's probably going to be another very cold London winter. What right now is going on your piece? What is in season at the moment?
Well, at the moment, from the vegetable point of view, we have a vegan pizza, so no cheese involved, tomato base, and roasted vegetables. In this case, we have courgettes, we have aubergines, and peppers. For the autumn, we're thinking a different menu, but we haven't finalized it yet.
What about the decision to be here on Northcote Road in Clapham? What brought that about?
I know the road very well. I set up my very first business in the pasta industry here in Northcote Road, so I'm familiar with the road, I'm familiar with the community. I still have a lot of friends around this area. I come regularly, and it was an easy step for me to come here.
That was Vittorio Maschio speaking to Monocle's David Stevens. Manifesto's seasonal menu is available now in southwest London. That's all we have time for today's edition of Sunday Brunch here in London. Thanks to all my guests. Thanks to you for listening. And thanks too to our producer and studio manager, George McDonough, and our researcher, Mariana Lagrasta. Coming up, Amber Arcades on the Midori House Sessions, and then from midday, Fernanda Augusta Pacheco and Augustin Macellari bring us the Monocle Weekly. During that, well, there's going to be all sorts of fun and games, including people from 6A Architects and the musician Richard Reed Perry from Arcade Fire. So tune in for that. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening and enjoy your Sunday brunch.